Today's lesson at Bossy's Finishing School for Difficult Women teaches you how to respond when a tech billionaire tries to buy his way into your cultural relevance. Step 1. Return invitation to sender. When Jeff Bezos drops over $10 million to sponsor and co-host the Met Gala, furrow your brow and say, Jeff, no amount of money is going to turn you and your wife into cultural icons. When your workers can't make ends meet, have to pee into bottles, and are punished for trying to unionize, a tux doesn't quite cover the black hole where your soul should be. Step 2. Remind them of the stakes. When celebrities show up draped in diamonds and money masks like they're making a statement while partying with the bozos like they're culture instead of capital, remind them. Honey, people are choosing between rent and groceries. Gas is pushing $7 a gallon, and the average American makes less in a year than your ticket costs for one night. So if the public isn't applauding your statement, it's because that isn't activism, it's dystopia in couture. Step 3. Add some windows to her ivory tower. When Anna Wintour is reportedly shocked by the backlash, tilt your head and say, Anna, you handed the night to a man whose company copies independent designers and boosts its own knockoffs. So forgive us if watching Lauren Sanchez glide down the carpet like wealth is a personality trait doesn't exactly scream high fashion. You don't get to dress up fast fashion and couture and act surprised when people call it tacky. Remember, ladies and gents, the Met Gala may benefit the Costume Institute, but somewhere along the way it stopped being about artistry and became a red carpet for oligarchs laundering their image. And when tickets have gone from $3,500 to $100,000, it's no longer a celebration of fashion, it's a receipt. And nothing is less stylish than confusing wealth with taste. Class dismissed.
Keep this frequency clear.
But guess what? You don't get to tell me when I can stop speaking. Well,
tune in to Queering the Air.
Report on trans and intersex issues with accuracy, dignity, and respect.
Get mad.
Change the narrative rather than combat the narrative.
Yes, Queen!
I know who I am. Took me 20 years to get here. I'm not gonna let some idiot senator destroy that.
3CR Community Radio.
Our stories are best told when we are the ones telling them. It helps combat the perpetuation of stereotypes, misinformation, and lies.
The TGDNB culture is valid, critical, vital, and vibrant.
I discovered in the face of overwhelming prejudice and persecution an incredible strength through being fiercely fabulous.
Welcome to Queering the Air, Sundays from 3 to 4 on 3CR. 3CR is proud to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which we transmit people-powered radio. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
Yes, welcome one, welcome all. Tis I, Madison Moffat. Ta-da! No trickery, really. It's just me. And I am here today on behalf of the Queering the Air franchise, the global franchise known as Queering the R in certain regions. And you're listening to it from 3CR at 8:55 a.m. on your radio dial if you're going old school, wicked. Or digital, if you're somewhat more, advanced in it. Or online, I don't know what. I'll have to impersonate Bill Gates, I think, for online. Or online on 3cr.org.au. But not yet, because we're still now. The show is on now, so it won't be on the web in that sense until afterwards. That is the difference between the present and the future. You heard it here. There we go. What do we call that? We call not timeless. What is it? I can't remember the philosophical term for time now. But temporal. There we go. Temporal. That is called temporal physics, everyone. I know it, but I can't spells or say it. All right. So I was this week, I think it was. Yes, it was. It was this week. I was at a place called the Red Betty, which is one of those bars in Brunswick where you actually have to enter from the back alleyway. Yes, yes. So, you know, it all felt very exclusive and trendy. And at the Red Betty, on the first Monday of each month, is a night called Headless Poetry. I like to call it Headless Chicken, but they've asked me not to. So I did two things. I listened to poetry, which, you know, is basically what the night is about. And while other people, other scallywags, sat around drinking, you know, alcoholic drinks and non-alcoholic drinks, I was hard at work, you know, because I have that ethic. Unlike some of these other quas, you know, I was solidly working, and which actually, as a matter of fact, made people worry about me. I was meant to be relaxing. And I interviewed two of the poets. So I'm going to play the first track, so to speak, which is essentially Zenana Vucic, at the Headless Chicken, the Headless Poetry event. And firstly, their poem, and then their interview. And, you know, the thing is, you know, people will go, oh, boy, how boring, an episode all about poetry. And, you know, I would be one of the first. I'm often the first to say such things when I have poets on. I have a little bit of a bit of banter, you know, it makes great radio. I'll have a little banter with the poets and say, we had a poet on 2 months ago and we still invited you. Oh, good fun. But anyway, it's seriously, though, when you talk to poets, you know, it's if they're not just, I don't know, playing Scrabble and then writing down what they come up with and turning it into some kind of pseudo verse, there's actually a lot of thought, and quite often a lot of socio-political or even hardline political or even philosophical insights that they can share as to what's driving them. So funnily enough, you're talking with someone who's, you know, quite literary minded, so they've got a high verbal reasoning, but the conversation turns to all kinds of other aspects of queer life, particularly if it's queer poets, queer, and particularly if I'm asking them, because I steer the conversation in that direction quite naturally, the insights that they can give, when they're not new, they're at least affirming, I find. So let's hear, firstly, let's hear from Zenana Vucic from the Headless Poetry. Now I've got to stop myself from saying chicken. From the Headless Poetry event. I was recorded this on this Monday. And it was, I don't know, about an hour or so after they'd done their little performance. Here we go. Here we don't go, because there we go.
In the spirit of the 1st of May, now the 4th of May, I'm going to read a couple of sort of broadly capitalism-themed poems, I think, and hopefully you enjoy the revolutionary spirit. Okay, this one is called Total Global Collapse. There is, of course, the fact of total global collapse, which I'm inclined to take too seriously or not seriously enough, depending on my mood and the difference in cost between the local bookstore and Amazon.com. I'm just going to say here, please order off Amazon.com. It's bad. We are trying to be better. We are trying to be. The fact is there are no good love poems, and most things can be said over email or text, which is not to say that either form is appropriate, and certainly neither is profound. You told me once that all our planets could fit into the distance between us and the moon, and we marveled at the size of our reality. Maybe I told you that. What I do know is that we talk about the moon often. Once, you turned her into a clementine and the earth into your fist and spun the two slowly to give motion to words like synchronous rotation and tidal locking. And still, it was impossible to understand. What I do know is that we have measured the distance between us and the moon and judged it not enough, not for our purposes. What I do know is that the universe is expanding and the moon is moving further away, and in a billion years there will be no eclipse. We've talked about this on the wet grass where muddy children play with muddy dogs, and we consider the ethics of having either in the face of total global collapse and our upcoming abandonment. I do not want children, which might be a political position, but it is a selfish one too. The thing about global collapse, the thing about universal expansion, is that you cannot know just how fast everything is leaving you. and in such a state of comprehensive uncertainty, what else is there to do but hold on to one another, fiercely? Insofar as our moon is concerned, I will let her go with good grace and my blessing, and take joy in the gentle way she unspools herself from us, an inch at a time and without hard feelings. But I cannot but hold tight to this, to now, to us. I told you once that I love you the way the sea loves the moon, which is to say that I am moved by the fact of your presence, which is to say that I am a moth under your light, which is to say many things which are not feminist and would embarrass me if I heard them out loud. The fact is, heteronormative love is probably against my politics, but what is politics in the face of total global collapse? And if we are to be set drifting in an untenable and volatile future present, is it not also necessary to take hold of what you love, to hold onto it even as a thousand big bangs explode into the silence, and universes are birthed between us, and around us, and inside us? We have sent each other many photos of the moon, rendered her a glowing orb and fuzzy halo, only to each time apologize for the poor quality of the shot, for the way we have turned her two-dimensional and too small. This is the problem with love poems, this two-dimensional and too small. I can see that it might be possible to translate magnitude and scale to the page, but what about splendor? What about joy? What about the soft warmth of my chest in sitting across from you over breakfast? The sudden expansiveness in my throat that renders me momentarily on the verge of taking flight. Is it not also necessary to take the moon in your mouth and collapse into the weight of her? If not, what could gravity do to stop us floating away? Inasmuch as there is anything to believe in, there is chance, accident, the question of a good book, unfinished, or two people and all the time on their hands. Inasmuch as there is anything to believe in, there is a pull across borders, curiosity, and then hunger. There is magnets and the way they move to convergence. There is gravity and the way it binds us into orbit. There is the moon and the sea. There is my heart calling for yours. There is a fact of total global collapse and the certainty of our uncertain future. I'm going to read an unexpected poem. This one is it's about the Bosnian War, and it's in memory of my uncle who recently died. It's called Blagaj Mostar. The sky was crumbling, so full of sun it burnt at the edges and hit the cracked earth of my aunt's garden in waves. It was a summer dense with figs splitting flesh on the tree. Pomegranates had burst open against the concrete drive, spilling their insides. On the steps, red chilies drying in neat rows on a white kadanya she had made herself. Bundles of herbs, thyme for chai and sage to cure a sore throat. A tidy line of orthopedic shoes, his and hers, a pair on each step. Months before, the lilac had been in bloom, the forsythia. We had walked around the garden, breathing them in, my aunt pointing to her silver beet, trellis beans, zucchini rattling against the soil, neat rows of carrot and potato. The apple and cherry trees had just shrugged off their blossoms. There had been elderflower juice. Today my aunt has cooked with a bountiful harvest. Spirals of cheese and spinach rolled in a pastry so thin you can see the new moon through it. Quarter chunks of tomato and cucumber dressed in oil. Sprigs of onion and yogurt. A loaf of fresh yellow bread. There's a watermelon cooling in the river for dessert. Beside it too, plums, persimmons, ripe fruit scattered across the ground to be fetched after the meal. Inside, baked apples stuffed with walnuts and fried dough soaked in sugar. We are waiting for my uncle, gone fishing. If he's lucky, my aunt will fry a river trout or two, lightly, with a little flour, a little salt, skin on and crispy. My uncle will make his same jokes, needling my kind aunt with her plum soft heart. Take this one away with you, he'll tell me. She's no good, just look at all this food she hasn't made. In the war, almost my lifetime ago, my aunt took her children in her arms and crossed the Barebone Mountains to our house. Hers had become a waiting grave. My uncle arrived every 3 weeks, a two-day hike in each direction. Limping, he wore a trail into the stone earth to find her, to sit in her weather for 3 days. Alhamdulillah, my aunt said. Well, where have you been? My uncle replied. Then he was gone. Then, as now, my aunt filled our plates, palachinka and ushtutsi when there was flour, pickled cabbage, stewed pears, bean soup stretched for weeks. My mother was a nurse in the village, and in the evenings the sisters sat together, drinking coffee when there was some, cracking walnuts between their palms, waiting for the men to come home. "Take this one with you," my uncle jokes. But he would follow. He knows the way. Above us, the old fort looms its jagged teeth across the mountain. After coffee, we will walk to its base, picking blackberries and water mint along the path, then stand on the karstic lip overlooking history, a tekia where old Sufi clerics chanted dhikr, and where the mountain split itself open to send our green buna swirling past the house. They say that after his death, a great cleric had his body buried in 7 tombs across the Balkans, choosing always small towns, out-of-the-way places, so that as pilgrims made their journeys to honour him, they would spread the word that there are as many paths to God as there are breaths in a human body. My aunt knows all the names of Allah, though like all our people, she says sabur, forbearance, most. My uncle is not a religious man, although he has been a pilgrim. This one is called Scumbloom. By the canal watching swans eddy through duckweed. We don't know anything. We call it algae. Make low noises at each other, furrow our brows. Worry that climate change will take everything before we've had our fill. Even our altruism looks inward first. We tell each other this is because you cannot see anything without looking through yourself. What I mean is, eyes are the window to the soul. And what is a window without glass? A hole. We are not holy, though it is right to marvel at the wonder of our bodies, all barriers, through which we look and absorb and consume, while swans dip their necks to skim life from a surface we are afraid to touch. Above us, a half moon tucks into the blue sky, and we think, this is the first time for everything. Right, I'm going to read 2 more. One of them is called There Are Rivers Underneath the Sea, and I'm going to read that one now. Everything begins like this, with a shipwreck. One body rent against another, salt and silt. Waves lapping at the crest, howling. What we aren't told is that there are rivers underneath the sea, that the world's largest waterfall plunges 3.5 kilometers through the waters between Island and Kalalit Nunat, and that the Bosphorus flows both ways, one atop the other, like a problem in math class. A ball thrown west on a train moving east, and so on. There are many such mysteries, and we come to them slow and suspicious. How, for example, can you tear someone apart without floating between you, an iceberg, unmelting? Or what makes the undersea rivers flow, avalanching through valleys and canyons into the abysmal plain, then go still for months or years at a time, but return? Or where does all the water go? Okay, I realize I've moved away from the capitalism theme, but I also realize that all my capitalism poems are also love poems, and that's very embarrassing. So I'm going to end on the final poem in my little book here, which you should definitely buy. Yes, exactly. This one is called Because a Wind Blazes. Because a wind blazes through the soft hands of autumn, I let the hurricane burn against my heart. What else are we to do with all this anger? The world will end, and we will let it. Every day, a kiss is stolen by one stranger from another. Every day, a building comes down on a child. They call this being unalived. This is the world that we are making. Not everyone gets to smell time on their fingers, or to cook a simple dish for the one who holds their heart. Not everyone gets a life in roses, nor even in crumbs. Yesterday, I saw wild horses graze a hillside in the fog. They could not look at me, nor me at them, for shame. Men tell me some of us are worth avenging, some of us are human, animals. This is a logic I've heard before, having once stood in a zoo and been fed to lions. The world grows small in rain, but it does not stay that way. Because after autumn, there are other autumns. We learn to eat the wind. This is what we shall do with all our anger. Eat the wind and spit it out. Sometimes the waves will rise so high in our mouths, they'll flood out and drown wind farms off the coasts of rich and modern countries. Sometimes we'll open our chests and, teeth first, throw ourselves from great heights. Do not mistake us. This is the world and we will take it. This is the longest moment ever. And this one. And this.
The book is called After War, and presumably you can find it at any good bookstore. Good, quote, unquote.
Well.
Sorry?
Some of the bad ones as well.
And some of the bad ones. Every single bookstore, it should have them. That was fantastic.
You're on 3CR with Madison, and I am with another rising star of the queer poetry world. Yes, we're in the midst of one of those people that we must revere, partially out of duty and partly out of social climbing. I will allow that person to now introduce themselves, name and pronouns, and their general view as to why they're here in the world. Nothing, no pressure.
Hello, my name's Janana Vucic, she, they, and that is a very big question and a daunting one. Why am I here in the world?
Yes, explain yourself.
Okay, look, has anyone told you about the birds and the bees?
Oh, yes.
Okay, yes. Let's...
And the flowers and the trees. Yeah, there is, yeah.
Okay, well, why am I here in the world?
And a thing called love.
This is ringing some bells now.
Yeah.
Okay, some haunting bells.
Yes.
What? I am here in the world. Why is anyone here in the world? I guess to just live our best selves with one another.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we convey our own meaning.
Exactly.
There's no inherent meaning.
No, exactly. And I actually find that so completely profound and so wonderful.
Yes.
And I think sometimes it really unnerves me that people find that daunting or somehow frightening, because I think there's so much possibility and joy in the idea that there's no inherent meaning, you have to make your own.
The flip side to that, though, is no one asked for it. Now I'm a big French classic existentialism now, you know, just completely ripping off the greats here, but no one asked for it.
And to therefore, be alive, you mean?
Yeah, to be alive, and so therefore, but they have to generate meaning.
True. Yeah. It was Camus that had the idea of the absurd, right?
Well, yes, and also Sartre and quite a few others, yeah. I think that's a good description of one's purpose in life. Rather universal, not particularly specific to yourself.
No.
But that's fine.
I felt we needed to go with a more general thing because it's such a big question. What is my purpose feels much harder to answer.
Cool.
Because I think I'm still trying to figure that out.
So what was your purpose to be on stage?
Oh,
more specifically.
Well, I was reading some poetry, and
yes,
a lot of it was about the war, and some of it was about capitalism, and
yes,
some of it was about love under capitalism.
Yes, they were the embarrassing bits.
They were the embarrassing bits. It does feel a bit embarrassing to talk about love.
Well, at least it was self-confessed to be embarrassing.
Yeah, I can't, no, there's just some feelings I'm not very good at talking about, and love is one of them. Love is one of them, definitely. It feels a bit, exposed and vulnerable, you know?
Yes. Yeah. That's a queer experience.
Yeah.
Because we are exposed.
Yeah.
What do you think we're exposed to specifically?
I mean, I guess there's the obvious ones, like violence and censor.
Yes.
But I think there's also the self-prescribed ones where you want to live up to an expectation that maybe your parents have for yourself, maybe you've absorbed for yourself.
Yes.
And some of those are about... Some of those are how to be heteronormative in the world, how to be quote-unquote normal in the world.
Yeah.
And some of those are also about how to be a good queer in the world.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, the good ones. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The ones that, I mean, are even worse, the corporate ones.
Got to be a girl boss. You've got to make that money. You've got to eat the cupcakes on Women's Day.
Exactly.
And have the flag in your banner.
Exactly.
And then not do anything else, I feel.
Are you okay? Are you okay?
It costs nothing to ask.
It costs nothing to ask, and you gain nothing answering it.
I actually walked past one of those ads today, and I just couldn't... Like, the sort of dissonance of reading it and being presented again with the idea of, like, so much funding has gone into this campaign.
Yes.
Rather than funding services.
Well, that's right. Now, your work touches on the chasm between what is expended and what is actually care.
Mm.
Yeah. Would you like to expand?
I just think that there is a big gap between what is afforded to people and what people deserve.
Yes.
And then also a big gap between what some of us are lucky enough to receive and others sort of have to spend their lives working towards, and then others will just simply never achieve because like, there's just not that capacity within those structures of oppression.
Yes. It doesn't come down to the extent of one's efforts.
God, no.
No.
No, one can try as hard as one will.
Yes.
For as long as one likes. But it won't make a difference in the end because some things will just be beyond us because the structures aren't made so that they will be beyond us.
Yes.
Because actually, capitalism and big corporations and Elon Musk and those types, they don't want to share the pie.
No.
They don't want a bigger pie. They just want more of the pie. And then they want to eat it on Mars, which sounds quite shit, to be frank.
Yes.
Like, not to poop on the Mars heads out there, but what's there? Everything good is on Earth.
Yeah, I think that part of the attraction for these idiots in living on Mars is that continuing to live on Mars ends up being the output of technical excellence, the application of engineering principles, therefore the application of those principles, because this is the sort of level of which these people think, becomes the raison d'etre for their whole existence.
I think the question of doing something for the sake of doing it and doing something because it ought be done are not the same things.
Yeah.
And I think there's a question of course, ought certain art be made? No, but is it probably good that like some weird wacky art is made? Yes, sure. But I think when it starts to impact global world and the global community, I think the question begs itself. I think the question of like, what are we doing with AI? I think that's a really good question because I think there are some great uses for it. Sure, like doing big math. I can't do it. Someone needs to.
Yeah.
Apparently AI can do it really quickly. But do we need it to take people's jobs when we live in a world where jobs are required in order to be allowed to exist within society?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we should fix that part of the equation first. Maybe we should have the universal basic income thing sorted out before we go back and make it so that no one has a job anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe in the interim, these people just pay some tax.
You know what? That's a great idea.
Yeah. How about they pay some tax?
Yeah, tax the rich, absolutely.
Well, you know, they're the ones that can most afford it. We're in a situation at the moment of where, you know, neoliberalism is now evolving into a feudal techno-fascism. And yet you persist on wanting to work towards, even just within your prose work and your poetry work, community of care. How best to bridge that?
Well, I don't know if you know, but poetry is actually very lucrative.
Yeah.
Sorry, I kid.
It's about $100 a US barrel, per barrel at the moment, poetry.
Exactly, yeah. Like just flying off the shelves as well.
Yeah.
I think there is no bridging it because it is somewhat of an impossible attempt.
Yep.
But I feel like the only thing we can do is make the attempt in whatever way we can. And I think for myself, writing is the way that I can do that.
Yep.
I'm not in a position to make political change because like I don't have a following of supporters on the internet. And I'm not a politician, but what I can do is write some things and hopefully something that I write resonates with someone and makes them think or feel something. And even if it doesn't, I'm just going to write another poem about capitalism and maybe that one will do the trick.
Yeah.
I think poetry is inherently an anti-capitalist form, just primarily because there's so little money in it. It might be different if people consume poetry like they do Heated Rivalry, but until that moment comes, it is inherently, I think, anti-capitalist. I think it's inherently radical, and I think one thing that it demands of us is to create work that is responsive to that. And sometimes that can just mean writing a little poem about love that no one is going to read or writing something that, yeah, at the end of the day, is somewhat of a subversion of capitalism because you're creating something without the intention of it or knowing even that it's not going to make you any money.
Hmm.
But sometimes that means trying to write something that speaks to the gross inadequacies under which we're forced to live.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the meantime, if Marx is right, and I think he might be, it'll destroy itself anyway.
I mean, it's coming.
You can feel it.
Yeah. I think this is an untenable situation, and I think we can all sense that. Don't know if the billionaires have realised yet, but we have the numbers. We have the numbers, we have the energy, we have the anger and the righteousness, the moral rightness.
It's actually brewing and bubbling. in a way that hasn't before, probably not for a good century.
I do feel that there is a sense of fury and discontent, and I think the moment of reckoning is coming. I think we cannot uphold these systems any longer. We cannot live in a world where the political class is so disconnected from the desires and will of the people and just continue that in perpetuity, because the people at some point will rise up. And I don't know, I think I have a lot of faith that that is coming.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for yours.
Hey there. You're listening to Queering the Air.
Coming to you live and direct on 855 AM. Or live streaming, man. That's cool. On 3cr.org.au/streaming. Or you can hear it on demand, man. That's just wild. Or not. It's all cool, man. It's all good.
Y+ Pride Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender attracted people, including bi, pan, regardless of label, or no label at all. We organise community events and advocate for better policies and services. Y+ Pride runs discussion groups which offer a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. Y+ Pride is especially keen to hear from multi-gender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Y+ Pride are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at byplusprideVic.org.au, email info@byplusprideVic.org.au, or find us on Facebook or Instagram.
A 3CR supporter.
I'm bisexual.
River to the sea, river to the sea, river.
Okay, so that was Bossi, B-O-S-S-I. On Instagram, they're known as I Am Bossi. All one word, lowercase, of course, because they're cool. Okay, and when I started the show, I played a monologue, which is titled How to Respond to the Bezos Met Gala. That was Bossi. So Bossi's a critic and a commentator and a musician. And I had to cyber clock them considerably in order to determine whether or not, what is she, was she, certainly very much aligned with the LGBTI community and has referred to her people as all of the queers, in as much as, you know, as in, you know, a grouping of people who are queer, of which she considers herself to be one. So without making a big deal about it, well and truly asserting themselves as part of the community. Right, so we're going to get back into Queering the Air expose of the Headless Poetry Night. And this time around, we're going to focus on the works of an artist that knows themselves as Enter the Vessel. Yes, no, their parents didn't name themselves that. They actually gave themselves that name. But then again, I can't remember what it is, but they also have another name that they go by during the everyday, so no need to be concerned for their welfare. Here is Enter the Vessel. Firstly, again, their poetry, and then a bit of a chat.
My name is Jem, also known as Enter the Vessel. I'm going to be recording tonight in the spirit of ritualistic performance. I'm going to be reading from my zine, which is called Body Memory Ritual. I don't want to speak too much on what this work is, except to say that reading it out loud is significant. It's called An Essay in Memes. I'm going to be skipping the memes. Something is happening inside of my body, and I name that something violation. The dye I use clings to my hands. I can't touch anything without leaving a stain. This is the fourth wash. It won't stop dripping off me. It's on the walls and floors, light switches. It has burrowed itself into a graze on the back of my neck, maybe permanently. My bed sheets are wrecked. I wake up tossing in it. This is the making present of the unseen, the unseeable. In the wake of this disorder, I leave evidence of my presence. I make visible my movements, my bodily boundaries expanding into the physical area around me. I imprint what I cannot yet communicate on my environment. Everywhere I go, I leave a mark. I transform space into territory. I was waiting for a hidden reality to reveal itself to me, even as I was unable to interiorize the fragments of that truth which had already been revealed by my body. Since I was young, I experienced my own thoughts and feelings and desires as foreign entities. So foreign, so totally unidentifiable and unaccountable that they could only have originated from outside of the body. I couldn't find a place within myself where these sensations would make sense to me, make sense for me. So I ejected them. I assigned them to an invading force or energy. Whatever could not be mentally metabolized must have belonged originally to something other than me. I examined each of my desires carefully, and if I found one to be somehow inexplicable, I orphaned it. The unthinkable evades classification as real. It cannot be thought, therefore it cannot be. Parmenides says, anything that can be thought necessarily exists and has existed all along. But what about that which cannot be thought? What about that which cannot be fully grasped by the mind, which is too sharp, too fluid, too out of place to make sense of? How can that which exists in a zone of unthinkability be rendered real? Where awareness evades me, I find my way through memory apathetically. Instead of trying to affirm what is known, I name what is not. I trace the outline of an unfathomable truth, a reality so intolerable that the only place it can be held is deep inside my body. How can the presence of an absence be made known? When I go to look for it, I will find nothing but a deep and swallowing shadow, impenetrable and inscrutable. But that darkness has a seam, a point at which it inevitably transitions into the light. I follow the borders of that abyss. I make a map of all the places it does not reach. After years of finding my peace and self-denial, I've begun my journey back to wanting. I invite foreign sensations back into the flesh. They make themselves known as hungry ghosts. I feel their will coursing throughout the body, free and boundless. I allow myself to accept these feelings as my own. I retake ownership of my aching, my craving, my needing, and then I lose my absolute shit. Because what I find not so far under the surface of desire is fear. Fear driven by desire or desire driven by fear. The direction of the correlation doesn't matter. The connection's there and it's clear. This one is immense and it is devouring and it is terrifying and it is shocking to find that it has been there all along. All I can do is cower before my desire. Phase 2, dowsing a scream. The fear is the guide. The fear is what will lead me to the other side. The first night, I struggle to sleep, fighting excitement and anticipation alike. I'm on a precipice, witness to the gravity of my awaiting transformation. I wake pinned down at the joints by a heavy, familiar ache. I'm trapped inside myself, crushed by an ungraspable weight, like a second body laid perfectly atop of me. It takes most of the day to shake off the doubled gravity. The second night, I lay awake, replaying memories of barred doors and fences and suitcases and missed opportunities to run. I bookmark my thoughts upon my freedom. I got out, I got out, I got out. I silently practice my screaming until 3 a.m. The third night, I am driven to mutism, muzzled by the atmosphere of unacknowledged pain, unfinished business. Nothing to see here, nothing to see here. I drift, deceptively gently, to rest. When I'm close, my breathing hitches, stomach turns, heart accelerates. Dread pulls me back from sleep. My cold sweat says that silence is no longer an option. Something moves through me, flowing under the surface of consciousness. I do not deny it, a conduit. Haunting is communicable, but only in the sense of contagion, not communication. You can catch someone else's ghost, but you cannot convince anyone of its existence. Haunting is fundamentally a mystery, which is to say it's not able to be expressed or understood in any way except directly, experientially. The ghost cannot be reduced to words. To do so would be to diminish it to a representation of an external object. Inseparable from its perceiver, the phantom exists in a state of anamnesis. Innately known before it is ever seen, a recollection that is understood prior to perception. What happens when a death goes unmourned, a body unburied, a crime unseen, ghosts unfed? What happens when there are no photographs to prove the case, no witnesses? What happens when all that remains is a memory, self-testimony, faith placed upon a fragmented inner experience? The seeker might never find material evidence of the ghost's existence. But that is not necessary. Paradoxically, spectral sighting can only come to fruition when the seeker is released from the burden of proof and consciousness is opened to embodied trust. In the end, the act of seeing the ghost in its fullness is enough to substantiate its form. There is a wound of omission within you, an unnameable neglect. You build your whole life in avoidance of acknowledging it. It dwells in your blind spot. You know there's something there, but you can't look at it directly. The mind fills in the blanks, knits together an image, as if there was never anything missing. All that is left is a sense that the scene doesn't quite add up. You shift your eyes and it moves. The mind protects you from the whole. I will be your spectator. I will face your aversion where I cannot face my own. A mirror pointed at a mirror. Can you see it in me? Can you see my silence? I catch the ghost of something I could not bear to confront in myself in your reflection. Here, I am enveloped fully into someone else's haunting, entangled in a dialectic of witnessing. The full picture can only be developed through an opposition of perspectives. But this is not my story. At the end of this, I get to walk away. More curious than afraid, I follow the pain inward. There's a truth inside of me so singular, so totally inexplicable, that its presence can only be made known in a story, a scream, a symbol. Is my silence natural, or is it an echo of having gone unheard, unrevealed, unconceived? I allow myself to go deeper into sensation, I release myself from the burden of explanation. There is no reason. There is no reduction. There is only time and space, closing in distance. Phase 3, submersion. A new god is born from a break in the ground of being. With this god comes a new world. My body resists form. It turns in upon itself at the meeting points. Joints like liquid, I lie down under the water. I meld with the stream. When I finally rise, all will go dark for a moment. I will allow it. The inevitability of this collapse is necessary. It brings me back to corporality. The ache is an anchorage. It is the pin that will hold me as temporality moves through the body. A wound is a portal, and there's one inside of me. It runs deeper and darker than I could have ever expected. Sometimes all that drives me is the desire to dive into this underground stream, to see where its current leads. It's through this opening that the forgotten will make its emergence. I flow from source to mouth. Somehow, I expected this journey to lead me to something that was placed inside of me by someone else. A memory object left behind in the psyche. Too blunt to recall, just solid enough to feel. Is that what I was hoping to find? A perfect puzzle piece to make sense of my disparateness? I see now my naivety. I've been approaching memory as if it was an entity that did not belong to me. It doesn't belong to anybody. No wonder it refused return. Standing on the shore of spiraling forms, ancient and solid and alive, I realize that I have been wrong. I thought I was here to bring a new god, a new truth into being. Now I see that it has been here all along, being birthed in perpetuity. Whatever I am on the precipice of discovering, I do not carry it alone. The immensity of this truth disorientates me. I press a hand into the living rock and it yields to me. These wounds exist on the earth and they have existed forever. Spatially tied breakages in the temporal order. This inexpressible scream pre-exists me. And yet I carry it, nascent, unmade in this body. When all is done, I am broken down. And thank God, and thank God, and thank God. Because this means I have hit the limit, the break, the point at which survival no longer suffices. I've entered into the revealed. Only I can feel this. Only I can be the origin of it. I relish the immediacy of these new, old, uncovered emotions. How they demand my attention as they arise. Sensation so firmly attached to my psyche, immediate and intense as opposed to delayed and dulled. I've reached a level of grounded consciousness that was previously inaccessible to me. The pain is immense, but it's mine in a way that I've never before experienced. I have all the instruments I require. An empty bottle for capturing the wind's howl, a camera, a pen, an audio recorder. A great gaping hole in my chest, passed down through my lineage. Maybe I am the inheritor of this burden so that I might be the one to finally make it known. Or maybe I am going to die silent, like those before me. I hit record.
My name is Jem. My pronouns are they, them.
If I was to attack you with a sausage and go, you know, what do you do? What would you come back with?
Mostly making memes. Is my art form.
So you
in
did...
a very, like, ironic way, I say that. But well, I consider it to be a modern perversion of the poetic tradition.
Yes. Well, I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like text is the perverted version of when the gentry used to send exciting little letters of love backwards and forwards to each other and get their couriers to send it.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I found it particularly interesting, your work. It seems to flit between the contingent, and I say contingent a lot, listeners will know that, what's concrete and what's spiritual. And it seems that what crosses between the two for you is the medium. Is that fair? The word, the text that sort of interflicts between the real and the unreal?
Yes, I think like language, this kind of tying force for me that makes things real. When you put it into words, it becomes real in a way.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when you're talking, for instance, your work about ghosts, it doesn't matter whether ghosts are real or not. You're talking about them, therefore there is some kind of matter to it now.
Yes, and I think it's a very psychological thing for me. The ghost for me is a very real phenomenon, but it's not real in the material sense.
No.
It's real in the psychic realm, I would describe it as.
The psychic, which is really just thought and how it's conveyed to others and how you therefore relate to the outside world.
Yeah.
So it's ontological.
Yes.
Because it's ontological, there is a matter there for you to contend with.
Yes, I am admittedly a Platonist. That is my great sin, is that I... I really dig Plato and...
But you're not a fascist, clearly not.
Yeah, goddamn.
Yeah, you obviously stopped somewhere down that pipeline, which is good news.
Yes, my thought draws from the Platonic concept of theory of forms and...
Yes.
...idea or concept as the basis of reality rather than a physical preceding that.
Yeah.
And so that influences my perspective on things like spirits and ghosts.
Yeah, yeah. No matter what shadow you present on the wall of the cave, it's there.
Yes. And the shadows are not, they're not the like true reality anyways. So the idea of a ghost can have more reality than the actual life that we're leading, the representations.
Yeah. And even though the cave is really there, it's a medium. So its relevance as a part of the concrete world is minimal.
Mm. Yes.
And it's really about it's a medium for what the shadow that you're falling on it. And it seems to me that it's similar. You're with your text.
Yes.
Would you say the text, or at least the platform through which you express the text, is the cave wall?
Well, the text itself does feel like a shadow in the sense that. Once you've captured it into this material form, you lose the original essence, you lose the idea. You have concretized it in a way that will make it such that some people will read those words and just not be able to comprehend it because you have to experience it.
Yes, yes. Some people suspend disbelief to believe the shadow, others negate it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think my writing comes from the body first. It comes from my way of moving through the world.
Yes. Well, that's ecstatic.
Yes.
Yes.
It is an ecstasis. Yes. So if you haven't moved through the world in that way, if you haven't experienced profound dissociation or bodily disconnection, it likely won't resonate. And especially the ideas that I build on about time, space, and spiritual entities might not resonate to people who haven't had those experiences as baseline.
So the ecstatic experience that extends beyond your physical self that people either will or will not understand and either will accept or may negate, is that a bridge towards areas of consideration like queerness? Because your text is not specifically queer, but I still get that sense.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm going to rave about the art form of memes for a moment.
Yeah, sure.
This was really my entry point. Through the medium of memes, I was trying to connect my experiences with gender and particularly the derealization that can happen with not feeling connected to your body, and trying to connect that to spiritual concepts of ecstasis and of feeling haunted, and how could I map those together.
What specifically haunts you?
Ooh. Well, when you put it like that, it seems
like almost blasé, like not in a negative way, but like it feels...
Well, I don't want to put too much weight on it just in case there's not much weight. You know, the extent to which there's weight to that question is up to you.
Yeah, because I guess I see haunting it as something that you can't put into words.
Right.
And so, like, the experience of being haunted is a breaking point with language.
Yeah, you express that in the work.
Yeah, so to say, like, what haunts me, it's like, I don't know, because I can't name it as a what.
Yes.
It's only an experience, yeah.
So the haunting is the lack of clarity, uncertainty, ambiguity.
Yeah.
A shadow, on the other hand, is more clear.
Yes. Yeah, like the shadow is kind of when you put it into the best words you possibly can.
Yes.
And some people will be able to interpret what the original thought object that you were trying to get at was.
Yeah.
And some people will look at it and it will be completely incomprehensible. Because once it's concretized, it's flat. It's flattened.
It collapses into itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I often think that queerness is a struggle between those who do not wish to be concrete do not wish to be made concrete, and those who do wish to make you so.
But of course there's like so many, like there's the political element of that where like you want recognition, you want to be readable.
Yes. Yeah. You don't. You want an audience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So comprehension has a place.
Yeah, but there is a limit to how much queer experiences are comprehensible in general, I think.
What about your individual queer experiences versus those queer experiences in the room?
I don't think I can hell... compare myself to others in that respect.
Is hell other queer people?
Not the people in this room.
No, that's right. Yes.
Everyone here is lovely.
Yeah. There's a unifying feeling, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Queer in the Air, Madison Moffat, 3CR, 855 AM, digital and online, 3cr.org.au. Woody Campfire, Perth-based folk troubadour, writes songs about things like trying to hook up with people in the rural areas. This is one of those. It's called Who Where. See you next week. Next up, Salaam Radio Show.
All told, it's cold in this cold old forest and I'm feeling all the tingles. A fella could warn this freezing tourist, so I check the local singles. Oh no, local just pass and trader, they need no romance finder. Just some fun for my holiday, the kind of rough you find on Grindr. Who's gonna come and give me some in this town? Who where? I'm nearly done with this town. Who where? Just one man, this whole damn town, and there's just one man. Who where? I'm out and I'm gay, but I don't have to live in a town that is this small. The gossip mill you'd have to contend with, any closets visible. His profile's blank, don't even got no text and no message, no reply. He might be looking for some freaky sex, he might want a younger guy. Who's gonna come and give me some in this town? Who where? I'm nearly done with this town. Who where? I don't know who you are, but I know where you are. I don't know who you are, but I know where you are. I don't know who you are, but I know where you are. I don't know who you are, but I know where you are. It's 1 in 10 Australian men. Somehow this town has none of them. Who where?